Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. The first segment of our show, we'll hear from Alexandria Fisher from Family Respite Services. So tell me a little bit about the latest happenings with Family Respite.
So Family Respite Services is an organization that works with 1,000 families who care for a child or a youth with a developmental disability, a medical health challenge, a child or youth with a physical disability, or mental health disorder. So what we do is we work with families to build a respite support plan so families can access many programs so that parents get a short break while children and youth are engaging in meaningful activities.
So how do you go about spreading the word about the work you do?
So Family Respite is always reaching out to our community because we need to ignite our vision. And by doing so, we rely on the community to make that happen. So we are so pleased to have a supportive community in Windsor, Essex, where we live. And again, we can ensure that children and youth have opportunities in our community where we can be inclusive and accessible to all people.
So are there any challenges in providing opportunities for these youth?
Well, of course, we have programs that are funded through the ministry, but obviously we always are looking to come up with new creative ways to meet the needs of families. So we definitely rely on partnerships and people who want to help us make our vision happen by coming on board financially or through volunteer opportunities or even paid opportunities working as a direct support provider.
So in your time with Respite Services, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
We have a lot to celebrate at Family Respite. So over the years, I've been at Family Respite Services. Together as a team, we're ensuring that we're responding to the respite need. Research shows that if parents are caring for a child with a disability, it can be 24/7. And so parents rely on that short break to re-energize. And that break ensures that the family can be healthy, be strong, and be a family unit together. So lots has happened over the years, but we're always working harder to respond to the need because there's hundreds of families on a wait list who are looking for respite services and respite support programs. So what we need to do as a community is come together on a continued basis to meet that demand.
So if you could send any message to the community about why it is that programs like this need to exist, what would you say?
We need you. We need individuals. We need businesses. We need corporations coming together. It takes a community, a village, right, to raise a child. And so we can't do it on our own. And so we welcome everybody to see our vision through. And there's many opportunities where people can get involved to respond to the respite needs. So we have lots of University of Windsor students working as a direct support provider. And what that means is just bringing the child out to the community, having fun, looking at the child's strengths, the child's interests, and then building an activity around that. So even just going to the park you know, kicking the ball around, shooting hoops, working on fundamental movement skills. And hopefully there's a chance at the park so that individual can meet their peers and it becomes more of a social opportunity as well.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you, Karen.
Of course. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Kevin Morton, who will be telling us a little bit about Rett syndrome. So tell me a little bit about your experiences with Rett syndrome.
So I have a 11-year-old daughter named Elle that was diagnosed actually 6 years ago on October 26th with Rett syndrome. Prior to her getting tested, my wife and I had absolutely no knowledge of what Rett syndrome is. And since we now live it on a daily basis, we've become quite intimate with what Rett syndrome is and how it affects Elle, and also how it affects other boys and girls and women and men that are diagnosed with it.
So, for those who might not be as familiar, can you give me an overview of how Rett syndrome might affect a person?
Sure. So, Rett syndrome is a neurodevelopmental condition. It's not degenerative, but it does change over time in a lot of people. So, it affects, with most boys and girls, men and women, their ability to talk. A very high percentage of them aren't able to use their voice to communicate. But now there's a computer system called a Tobii that is allowing them to use eye gaze to be able to communicate. It affects their gross motor, their fine motor abilities. There's scoliosis involved. There's seizures involved. There's long QT heart issues that are involved. It's quite a long laundry list of complications as a result of Rett syndrome, on top of the normal complications of human life anyways, with cold, sicknesses, and flus.
So what's been the biggest support system that you've had since the diagnosis?
So the Ontario Rett Syndrome Association has been around for 25-plus years. They've developed these programs with three hospitals in Ontario. One's the CHEO Hospital, the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario. One's Haldimand Bloorview in Toronto, and the other one's Thames Valley Children's Center in London. They provide funding for a nurse practitioner that allows us to go in, and once a year we have an appointment or as necessary, and we, in the model in London, we meet all of Elle's support staff. So we meet a neurologist, we meet the geneticist, we meet her osteo, we meet pretty much all the resources that we need in one appointment.
So were there any challenges in facing the diagnosis once you realized?
I mean, it's a life-altering diagnosis. I mean, Rett syndrome doesn't go away. It only kind of gets worse as, in our case, Elle gets older. It's coming to the understanding that there's going to be a new normal for us. And what we thought was going to be a normal life is going to be a different normal. With Elle right now, she's got some pretty serious issues with her spine and her curvature there that we were really hoping we didn't have to deal with, but we have. It means for us as a family, or her parents, is really never getting a minute off. Even when she's sleeping, now that she's 11 years old, she still has a monitor in her bedroom. Typically for an 11-year-old, you wouldn't have a baby monitor in their bedroom. And I mean, it's for us to have a peace of mind that we always have an eye on her when she's sleeping in case she does have a seizure, which she has had at night. So as a parent, it's now about being able to provide the best quality of life for her and for our other daughter as well. But it's about never being able to have a minute off. One of us always has to be on.
So to look at the converse side of things, with the support and I'm sure contact with other families who are facing similar circumstances, have there been any successes that stand out for you?
I mean, there absolutely has. I mean, Elle is a very determined little girl. She has a goal in her life that she wants to play hockey. So for her, she still has her ability to walk, and she wants to play hockey, so we've told her that she has to be able to skate. So Elle has the ability to skate on her own. On weekends, I take her out on the ice. She loves that because she knows the next step is to play hockey. Even though it's a long shot for her ever to be able to play hockey, that's one of her goals. So, I mean, there is definitely success stories out there. I mean, in terms of the Rett syndrome world, there's a lot of research being done worldwide in terms of trying to find either a total cure for Rett syndrome or else a partial cure or some pharmaceutical product that makes the girls' lives and boys' lives better. So that has a lot of promise to us.
So if you could send any message to the community about why the work going forward must continue, what would you say?
Oh, that's a tough question. I mean, it's just, for me, so my wife and I, we raise money for the Rett Association in Ontario, and a lot of it is we just want to be able to provide a better quality of life for these individuals. It's nothing that they've done wrong, or it's a random genetic mutation in majority of the cases. So these girls didn't have a choice in this, and they're literally trapped within their body because neurologically and functionally, they're all there. Like, they get everything, they understand everything. So to be trapped in your own body is something that I couldn't imagine. Like, we just want to be able to provide the opportunity to set these girls, some people use the word set them free, or allow them to show their full abilities.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure, no problem.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Innovative Designs for Accessibility student competition is now open and ready to inspire students to create innovative and effective ideas that can resolve accessibility barriers within our community. Group or alone, undergraduate or graduate, full-time or part-time, the competition is open to all University of Windsor students that are willing to submit and present an idea for a chance to earn cash prizes up to $500. Competition closes January 31st. If you have any questions or concerns, you can email idea@uwindsor.ca. That's idea@uwindsor.ca. Or visit uwindsor.ca/OHREA/idea-competition for more details.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Kevin Morton and Alexandria Fisher. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Cindy Jang, will be telling us a little bit about her disabilities research and her background experience in poverty and disability. So, what can you tell me about your disabilities research?
My disabilities research is looking at invisible disabilities in the workplace. Primarily, I want to be looking at stigma and disclosure amongst small teams. And the reason why I'm focusing on small teams is because that's where their support is, and that's where people talk to each other, and that's part of their daily lives.
So, in terms of disabilities employment, when such a person has difficulty in obtaining it, do you find there's any sort of backlash in the quality of their life as relates to?
Definitely. Income is such a huge part of anyone's life, and having a disability and access and being able to have employment impacts anyone's livelihood. And it's difficult for people with disabilities to obtain employment, not because of their skill. I would argue it would be because of the stigma that exists in society for people with disabilities about their abilities and disabilities.
So there's also the question of the myths and misperceptions out there concerning accommodations. Have you encountered a lot of that in your research?
I have. In the work that I've done in British Columbia looking at employment opportunities for people with disabilities with the Craftwork Society, it's a nonprofit organization for people with disabilities, and we were trying to connect our participants to jobs with industry employers in British Columbia, and we found that a lot of them weren't too sure how to approach accommodation or what that accommodation looked like. And there was a fear that accommodation could potentially impact their bottom line.
So when it comes to things like that, for an employer, it's a financial cost. But to a person with a disability, we're talking their livelihood, their ability to get food, medical care, shelter, the whole gamut.
Oh, yes, definitely.
So what do you find are some of the biggest challenges concerning people with disabilities finding the right employment?
I think this is a twofold question, Cam. The first one is for people with disabilities, such ingrained stigma in society that we are fearful of disclosure. And I do say we're fearful because I am a person with invisible disabilities, and I've gone through that process many times, which is actually one of the reasons why I'm doing my PhD in this area, is because I do have invisible disabilities and I do need accommodations, and I've been an advocate in this area for quite some time, and it's still quite hard for myself. And so I'm thinking about the tools that we can share to figure out how we can navigate the system.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your research and your own experience among people with disabilities, has there been any success that you've seen in regards to employment?
There has, actually. And this is also in reference to the Craftwork Society programming over in Vancouver. So they're a nonprofit organization that works with people with disabilities through a craft therapy and also an industrial sewing program. And through the industrial sewing program, some of our participants were able to secure part-time jobs doing industrial sewing, some of it in-house and some of it for other organizations, which is pretty amazing.
So if you could send any one message to the community about the need for equal inclusion and why it is we should encourage our workforce to have people with disabilities, what would you say?
I would say that it enriches the workforce. You have better diversity viewpoints in terms of creating a better and inclusive society. And you'll also have amazing workers because people want to work, and the fear of not being accepted and then being accepted is truly amazing, not just for the organization hiring the person because they will have a great employee, but also for the person to be able to contribute and be a part of a community.
So are there any steps you can think of that we as a society can do towards tearing down the myths and barriers and helping ourselves keep an open mind?
Well, that's also a part of my PhD, Cam, looking at how we can have those discussions or disclosure and non-judgmental conversations in the workplace. At this point in time, I'm not too sure if there is any, if we do have a lot of tools to use in the workplace. One step I think of from my own personal experience is that trying to find one person in the workplace for me that I was able to disclose to, and they were a true ally and were able to step up and advocate for inclusion without outing my disability.
Well, one of the great tragedies when it comes to disabilities employment is a person with an invisible disability might have that hesitation and say, why should I even bother? They wouldn't want me to be a part of the staff anyway. So do you ever find that a person with a disability will not apply for something, even if they could do it, on the grounds of that kind of fear?
I would say yes. There is a lot of fear of rejection and the stigma of being labeled as somebody with a disability can really impact someone. And so there is that reluctance because as in the system, going through school, going through university or post-secondary or any other avenue, a lot of people with disabilities have been told time and time again that these are the areas that you're not good at. These are your limitations. And what we really need to do is look at asset building and not look at limitation adjustment.
So when it comes to that sort of mentality that says you couldn't do this, does that tend to be based more on actual experience and data, or is it just, oh, you're someone with a disability, we'll dismiss you out of hand thinking?
This is more anecdotal, and so this is also where my research is going to be looked at. But I also know from going through the high school system, when we're talking about people's strengths and limitations, especially those with disabilities, it's like, well, you should try this instead of this area, or maybe this area would be better for you. And I think we can change the language in terms of, if that's your goal, let's see how we can get you there.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
So next up, we're going to hear from a young PSW student who will be telling us a little bit about her training and her experiences.
Hi, I'm Kat, and I've been in the PSW program for 2 months now at the Canadian College of Health and Sciences and Technology. It's an amazing program. You get to experience to work with people who are people you wouldn't like deal with every day, but it's amazing. I love helping people.
So what was it that led you to the program in the first place?
To be honest, it was my dad. He's a cancer patient fighting 5 years now. He's getting a bone marrow transplant in Hamilton. And when he was in care, I didn't really like the care. So I figured, you know what? He's been there all his life for me, and a lot of people like him need the help and the care, like compassionate care. And I think I'm fit for that. That's what made me go into it, my dad.
So have there been any challenges in the program so far?
Honestly, no. It's so straightforward. They tell you what you need to know. If you're doing wrong, they say, hey, you're not supposed to do this. It's a really, like, straightforward program. It's hard. It's competitive. Like, if you're in the field, it's challenging every day. It's the best part is you will get to work with different people every day.
So has there been any success moments so far in your training or your work?
Yeah, actually. I actually had a practical test the other day, and I don't know. I feel like I did better than I thought I would. I want to say, like, I don't know. It's really hard to explain. It's like a visual thing. Like, you have to be there to see it. So
makes sense.
Yeah.
When it comes to testing, we all tend to kind of underestimate ourselves.
Yes.
So what are your hopes for when you graduate the program?
Honestly, my hopes are to work at the hospital or long-term care and help out as much as I can and pretty much give back to the community.
So if you could send any message to the community about why it is that personal support is essential to any patient's recovery, what would you say?
I'm going to say Okay, there's a lot of people with like background histories that nobody knows anything about. And when they are in a long-term care, they should be treated a special way, no matter who it is. Okay, so it's pretty much like putting yourself in someone else's shoe, treating them the way you want to be treated in the future, being in their place, and how, pretty much how you want to be treated.
So do you find there's enough compassion and enough understanding in society to make this possible?
I want to say yes, but seeing what I've seen on my end, I would say no. Like, I haven't seen the compassion that a person deserves. When I go visit my dad, I see how they are treated. I'm not telling you with attitude-wise. I'm just saying how they take care of a patient, it's not right. Some people just neglect. And they don't show much love and stuff. So I would say I'm trying to kind of bring that out working as a PSW.
So you do think then that there's hope,
yes,
that this sort of compassion can come along.
Yes.
But honestly, that's the best way to change a system,
yes,
by being a part of it and setting the example and saying we can do better.
Or you can just start off by going into community and volunteering and putting your time and effort in doing the right thing so others can see you doing the right thing and then they can just follow your footsteps.
So what are the next steps in your work?
My work? First I want to start off by, I want to start off in the field before I'm in it, like volunteer kind of thing.
So by the time the end of the formal training comes, you'll be thinking to yourself, I know all this, what's
yes,
next?
Yeah, I'll be ready to go in and just doing what I have to do. Mm. And I don't care what it takes. And if I want something, I get it done. If I want to show compassion and love towards other people, I will. And I will show it. It's my goal.
It's absolutely your place. And, well, anyone can be the change in the world that they want to see, you know?
Yeah.
It's good to see that there is some hope, and going forward,
yep,
you're going to continue to make a difference.
Yes, I am. I'm going to start soon. I'm not going to say where. It's going to be a surprise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with the audience?
Follow your dreams, and pretty much just, there's going to be people on your way telling you you can do this. It's not for you. It's not the right path for you. You know yourself. Just follow your heart. You know what you're good at. Just go out there. If you want to make a change, go out there and do it.
Thank you very much for taking the time. The truth, my friends, is we need more optimism, more hope in the medical community. For people with disabilities, the last thing that they need is to go into a care facility and feel that people are resentful of doing their jobs. Fact is, medicine is not the assembly line. It is not seeing how many people you can diagnose and get through in an hour. Time, care, patience, understanding. These things are the hallmarks of disability life and care. And the truth of the matter is, compassion is always welcome. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.